Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books and Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the channel with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Professor Claudio Lopez Guerra. His new book is titled Democracy and Disenfranchisement, The Morality of Electoral Exclusions. It has just been published by Oxford University Press. Lopez Guerra is research professor in the Department of Political Studies at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics in Mexico City. Modern democracy is built around a collection of moral and political commitments. Among the most familiar and central of these concerns voting. It's commonly held that legitimate government requires a system of universal suffrage. Yet Democrats tend to hold that certain exclusions are nevertheless permissible. For example, it's commonly thought that children and the mentally impaired may justifiably be disenfranchised. We also tend to think that the disenfranchisement of felons and non-citizen residents is permissible. Indeed, these exclusions are often thought to be consistent with universal suffrage. In Democracy and Disenfranchisement, Claudio Lopez Guerra challenges our common understandings about voting. Ultimately, he argues in favor of an elitist system of enfranchisement by lottery. He also challenges arguments that universal suffrage is consistent with the exclusion of children, the mentally impaired, felons, and resident non-citizens. The result is a fascinating and provocative exploration of the fundamental idea that voting is a basic right. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Claudio Lopez Guerra.
Hi, Bob. Thank you for inviting me to your show. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you for agreeing to talk to us today on New Books in Philosophy. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. Today, my guest is Claudio Lopez Guerra. We'll be talking about his new book, Democracy and Disenfranchisement, The Morality of Electoral Exclusions. This is a challenging and provocative book that I highly recommend. In it, Claudio lays out a common conception of suffrage among Democrats and Democratic theorists, and then challenges it thoroughly. To be a little more precise, Claudio subjects to criticism the common views about who may vote, who may be denied suffrage, such that whereas we commonly hold that, say, children and felons may be disenfranchised, Claudio denies this. More strikingly, he argues for a system by which large numbers of citizens would be disenfranchised for being politically incompetent. Now, we just had an election in the United States.
In fact, while we're recording this, it was last week. So perhaps it's fitting to discuss issues like these after an election that I suspect had results that many people were disappointed with. So there's a lot to talk about. But first, Claudio, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I was born and raised in Mexico City. I was lucky to have a relatively well-off family. However, as I was growing up, I participated in several social work projects during secondary and high school, which made a very important impact on me because I was faced with the reality of millions of my compatriots, most Mexicans who live in very dire conditions, and I was honestly shocked by the reality in which they had to live in. And that was contrasted with my own experience, and that moved me to try to think and do something, you know, about this reality. And that's how I started asking, you know, the basic questions in political philosophy: what is a just society? What should we do about the suffering of all these individuals? To what extent are we responsible, and so on? And so that's how I got involved in moral and political philosophy. I first did a BA degree in political science, and then I went to do the PhD also in political science, with an emphasis, of course, in political philosophy at Columbia University. I was very lucky to have wonderful advisors there. I worked with Jan Elster, Brian Berry, Thomas Pogge, and David Johnston, and this was a wonderful experience. And well, after
that sounds like a very nice group.
yes, it was excellent. And around that time at Columbia, there were other major theorists as well in other departments in the law school. Joseph Rass was there, and also Jeremy Waldron. So, and of course, well, you know, the academic life in New York, with, you know, the other universities around New York University and Princeton and Yale being so close. Well, it was definitely a very stimulating environment for me. And well, after graduation, I returned with my wife to Mexico City, and we reunited with our old friends and families, and we've been here since then. I now teach at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics, better known as CIDE, in Mexico City, which is a kind of institute for advanced study in the social sciences. Basically, it's a public institution, and I'm in the department of political studies there, doing all this work on the normative dimension of public issues.
Well, excellent. It's always nice to hear that somebody's gotten into political philosophy as a result of confronting something actually political. So let's turn to the book, Democracy and Disenfranchisement. So it seems to me that the book, we can think of the book as sort of pressing a sort of dual view. First, you want to reject a standard view among Democrats about suffrage, and you want to replace that view with a different kind of view of suffrage. And this is all in the service of a sort of broader inquiry into the justifiability of excluding people from the franchise. But the way that you set up the issue is you contrast two doctrines about suffrage, the critical suffrage doctrine, which is your own doctrine, and the more common, as you call it, conventional suffrage doctrine. Can you tell us a little bit about those two doctrines and their contrast?
Sure, of course. Now, to get there, let me first say that, well, the book is largely response, an intellectual response to an ongoing practical problem. So that's how I got interested in this topic. The allocation of the right to vote continues to be a very important practical problem in many countries. In the United States, there are some important controversies, for instance, yeah, whether felons should be allowed to vote. And this is, not only in the United States, but in many other countries. So most of the cases I deal with in the book are ongoing practical problems. And when I started thinking about these issues, I was surprised by the fact that in political philosophy, we have actually neglected the right to vote as a subject of serious intellectual inquiry, which we just simply take it for granted. And we haven't really isolated for serious philosophical scrutiny as we have done with other rights, such as the right to freedom of speech. So in starting to think seriously about these problems, whether felons should vote, whether the mentally impaired should be allowed, whether the voting age should be reduced, whether expatriates should be allowed to vote, all these things. I was dissatisfied with the standard approach to these cases in the literature as well as in political discourse. And this standard approach simply assumes, it takes for granted that the right to vote is a basic, a fundamental right, and that in thinking about these cases, we should approach them with that premise in mind, the idea that the franchise is a basic moral right. So I started questioning this, and in the end, I found myself disagreeing, indeed, with the way in which most people understand the nature of the right to vote as a fundamental right, and also what they think we should be doing in all these cases. So indeed, the purpose of the book is to criticize what I call the conventional suffrage doctrine. In the book, I lay out this doctrine as having five precepts. The first one is that it is never permissible to exclude sane adults for being politically ignorant. The second precept is that the exclusion of minors and the mentally impaired can be justified. The third precept is that the exclusion, the disenfranchisement of non-citizens residing in the polity is justified, whereas, and this is the fourth precept, the exclusion of citizens residing in another polity cannot be justified. And finally, most people believe that disenfranchising felons is permissible. So basically, what I argue in the book is that we should adopt the opposite of this conventional suffrage doctrine. I call it the critical suffrage doctrine, which argues basically the opposite of these claims. So specifically, I argue that if done through a specific method that I call the enfranchisement lottery, universal suffrage is not justified. And this undermines the first precept of the conventional suffrage doctrine, because the enfranchisement lottery, as I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to discuss in the conversation, is a device that would exclude the vast majority of people on the basis, on the presumption that they are not sufficiently competent to vote. In the book, I also argue that in the backdrop of universal suffrage, it is hard to justify the exclusion of minors and the mentally impaired, as well as the exclusion of felons, whereas it is hard to justify the exclusion of non-citizen residents and non-resident citizens. So, indeed, what I do in the book is to argue that some forms of disenfranchisement that most people deem acceptable, when we think seriously about them, they are not acceptable. Whereas some forms of disenfranchisement that we regard as unacceptable are, in fact, acceptable.
Right. So and now our listeners will hear what I meant when I just a moment ago said that the book was provocative, right? It seems as if you're starting with a pretty apt description of some ordinary thoughts among democratic citizens, and I should add democratic theorists, about voting, and saying that our central thoughts about these things should be rejected, or at least there's a strong case to be made for rejecting them and accepting their negations. So why don't we begin then in sort of working through some of these components of the critical suffrage doctrine. And I take it that there might be some respects in which the first premise that of the critical suffrage doctrine, that it is permissible to exclude large numbers of people on the basis of their political ignorance, in the wake of an election, at least in the United States, might not be so unpopular. Can you tell us a little bit about what you call the enfranchisement lottery, which is your alternative?
Sure. So let me give just a little bit of background first.
Sure.
In the effort of justifying democracy, political philosophers have always tried to thought of alternatives, right? And by democracy, of course, I mean mostly modern democracy, of which universal suffrage is a critical component. And, you know, so the exercise of justifying universal suffrage and democracy versus alternatives is inevitably a comparative exercise. Now, the most important alternative to universal suffrage in the literature is John Stuart Mill's plural voting system. And I think political philosophers defending universal suffrage have certainly done a pretty good job in rebuking Mill's system. But I don't think that we, political philosophers, have done a pretty good job in thinking about other alternatives to universal suffrage. So the moment we start thinking seriously about the allocation of the right to vote as a problem of institutional design, as a problem of thinking about alternatives that may be justifiable, then we will find that we haven't done really a good job in this regard, that there are alternatives to universal suffrage that are not Mill's plural voting system that will make us reconsider, perhaps, or that's what I try to argue, the normative status of universal suffrage and consequently the status of the right to vote as a fundamental right. So the enfranchisement lottery is precisely that, an alternative allocation, an alternative system for allocating the right to vote. So the idea is as follows. So imagine universal suffrage in the best possible way according to your own standards. And then imagine that we draw a random sample, we select a random sample of individuals from that universe of potential voters. I call this device the exclusionary sortition, because it would tell us who would not be entitled to vote in the next election. So those who are not randomly selected through this sortition would be excluded for the next election. Now, suppose further that once we have this group of individuals that we might call the pre-voters, call them the pre-voters because they would not necessarily be automatically entitled to vote. Suppose that they, in order to become enfranchised, finally enfranchised, they would have to go through what I call a competence-building process to acquire relevant information about the alternatives on the ballot. Now, just to give an idea to our listeners of what this entails, I mean, this is clearly inspired to some extent by the literature, the recent literature in democratic theory on mini-publics, which consists on the creation of representative samples of the population that would then become more competent or enlightened by acquiring relevant information, and this would be a way of keeping the virtues of inclusion while at the same time improving the epistemic quality of the process. So what I argue is that this system, the enfranchisement lottery, would be preferable to universal suffrage from an epistemic point of view. That is to say that there are reasons, good reasons, to believe that under this system, the quality of electoral outcomes would be better, and that therefore, from this purely epistemic perspective, Democrats and advocates of universal suffrage cannot reasonably object to it. A next claim I make is that, nevertheless, universal suffrage has some advantages over the enfranchisement lottery. Specifically, it is the universal suffrage is a mechanism for deciding who is going to exercise political power that is more transparent and less conflict prone than the enfranchisement lottery, in the sense that, at least in certain contexts, there could be reasonable doubts about whether the sortition and the competence building process of the enfranchisement lottery was truly impartial and random, whether it was, you know, that it was not rigged and so on. So these doubts, especially in certain contexts, contexts of polities with where the rule of law is not well established and where there is a history of corruption and distrust in public institutions, in those contexts, we can imagine that the operation of the enfranchisement lottery could actually lead to post-electoral conflicts that would be problematic, whereas universal suffrage has an advantage over the lottery system from this perspective that I call in the book the perspective of political stability. However, I do argue that in other contexts, in contexts of well-established democracies with a strong rule of law and low levels of corruption and high levels of trust in public institutions, these relative disadvantages of the enfranchisement lottery would be muted, so that it would be perfectly acceptable to adopt this system, the lottery system, in those societies for purposes of the epistemic gains that we can reasonably expect, as well as other advantages that it has, such as a reduction in the costs of the electoral process, which is a relevant consideration since, I mean, we can use that extra money to fight poverty or develop other social programs, for instance. So basically, what I do is precisely argue that the enfranchisement lottery is a justifiable alternative to universal suffrage that excludes the vast majority of the people in a society from the right to vote, and that therefore it is difficult to think of the franchise as a basic moral right.
Excellent. Let me just ask a question about the enfranchisement lottery. A lot of the work, at least that I'm familiar with, about mini publics and deliberative polls and these kinds of sort of theoretical endeavors to improve the epistemic quality of democratic decisions by sort of taking smaller groups and trying to improve them epistemically as far as the political issues go. A lot of these proposals want ultimately to make a claim about how a properly construed mini-public and a properly informed mini-public would be making decisions that a properly informed universal suffrage population would make, that somehow there's some representativeness of the properly informed mini-public so that what they choose is what the broader population would choose anyway if they were properly instructed. I didn't see in your view any claim about the representativeness of the enfranchisement, the results of an enfranchisement lottery. Is that right? That you're not committed to the claim that Once we've got we select a demographically representative sample of pre-voters and then subject them to this competence building exercise, you're not committed to the claim that then what the competent ones would choose can be understood as representing what the broader population would choose if everybody were competent?
No. So I do not understand the enfranchisement lottery as institution, as a device that would be representative in that sense, mm-hmm. In the sense that, you know, that the voters that would be randomly selected would be acting as the representatives of the rest of the population. No, actually, my claim is that the enfranchisement lottery is an alternative to universal suffrage, and the voters in that system would not be accountable to the rest of the population in that sense. They would not be their representatives. This is just an alternative system for allocating the right to vote. Now, there is an important sense, however, in which the enfranchisement lottery would be quote-unquote representative, which is that, indeed, if the sortition is properly done, properly carried out, the group of voters that would be selected would be demographically identical to the group of voters under universal suffrage. So this is actually a very important reason why the advocate of universal suffrage would not be able to object to this system from an epistemic point of view. That is to say, the electorate under the enfranchisement lottery would not be biased in favor of some demographic group. So from this perspective, let me put it this way. So if we eliminate the second component of the enfranchisement lottery, what I called the competence building process, and we only carry out the exclusionary sortition, then under this system, we would have exactly the same results as we get under universal suffrage, because the electorate would be identically would be composed in an identical way to the electorate under universal suffrage. So the worries that political philosophers have expressed about systems like Mill's plural voting system, such as the worry that along with education, that education is correlated with other traits such as wealth and income, and that would produce a biased electorate that would neglect the interests of the poor. I mean, that kind of objection wouldn't apply to my system, precisely because the sample would be representative of the whole. However, I do want to insist that the voters under this system would not be the representatives of the rest of the citizens. This would just be another system for deciding who is to have the right to vote.
Excellent. That's a helpful clarification, especially in setting apart your view from some other proposals that have been made in the name of, you know, sort of middle of the road mainstream democratic theory. So let's then turn to the view, the next sort of element, which is children and the mentally impaired. So the standard or the conventional suffrage doctrine maintains that it's permissible to withhold suffrage or to disenfranchise children and the mentally impaired. Your view, the critical suffrage doctrine, denies this. Can you tell us a little bit about this component?
Sure. Let me just first make an important clarification. In the process of arguing for the different precepts of the critical suffrage doctrine, well, the first one is, as we just discussed, a direct attack on the idea that there are no justifiable alternatives to universal suffrage. But then, in discussing these other cases, the mentally impaired, children, felons, and so on, I am no longer thinking about these two alternatives, universal suffrage and enfranchisement lottery. I am simply assuming a backdrop, an institutional backdrop of universal suffrage. I do this because one of the purposes of the book is to shed light on current practical controversies. So what I'm trying to say is that my answer to the question of whether children, the mentally impaired, felons, and all these other cases that follow should be or may be disenfranchised presupposes universal suffrage as a backdrop, as the institutional background. I leave it as an open question whether what we should do about these cases if a system of enfranchisement lottery were in place. So having clarified that, let me now go over, the argument for thinking that the exclusion of children and mentally impaired individuals is hard to justify in a society with universal suffrage. So the standard argument for excluding these types of persons, children and the mentally impaired, is instrumental and it's epistemic. The idea is that if they were to have the right to vote, then the quality of electoral outcomes would suffer somehow. Now, I don't think that we have actually pretty good arguments for arriving at that conclusion. So typically when people think about these cases, they imagine an electorate that is entirely composed of children and mentally impaired individuals. Whereas the relevant question to ask is whether in conjunction with the other voters, their inclusion would tend to deteriorate the quality of electoral outcomes. Another problem that is frequently made is that, for instance, by Robert Dahl and other democratic theorists, is to make the claim that, well, these individuals clearly are not capable of ruling the polity. But in voting, we are not ruling. This association is obviously problematic, and we would certainly reach different conclusions if what were at stake is different forms of political involvement or participation. So the question, the relevant question, I think, is whether adding these groups of persons to the electorate, as we currently know it, would make matters worse. Now, I do not think that there are any compelling theories or studies showing that this would actually be the case. So what exactly would the enfranchisement of these types of individuals would have to produce in order for us to say that the quality of electoral outcomes has worsened? I think that's the relevant question. We cannot say, for instance, that every now and then, perhaps, the outcome would have been different. I mean, if one party wins or another wins, I mean, in the end, we cannot simply say that this would justify the disenfranchisement of an entire group to begin with. If an electoral outcome would be entirely unacceptable morally, then there would be reasons to ban that party in the first place rather than to exclude the voters that would presumably vote for them. Now, children and the mentally impaired would be voting for one of the established options that other sane adults, citizens, would be voting for. So it would be very difficult just to say that the difference in outcomes would signal lower quality. What we would have simply is, as it currently happens for other reasons, I don't know, the weather and other reasons, you know, outcomes turn out to be different by a small margin. And just saying that every now and then the outcomes might be different after the enfranchisement of these persons wouldn't be any proof that they would have been different for the worse. So what we would need is some kind of evidence that the enfranchisement of these groups would actually produce lower quality representatives, such as, you know, the idea would be that if these groups were enfranchised, more corrupt and abusive leaders would be elected, or that parties that are currently not running or non-existent would suddenly emerge and they would have some terrible moral views and they would gain some political influence. But we simply have no reason to believe that such things would happen. In the end, these individuals would be voting for alternatives that are already established and deemed acceptable to run and to compete. And all of the theories saying that perhaps these individuals are more easily influenced, or that they wouldn't be really knowing what they're doing at the polls, don't really amount up to a compelling case that epistemically their enfranchisement, compared to the enfranchisement of other sane adults, would deteriorate the quality of outcomes. In the end, also, one can invoke arguments about the long-term effects of the enfranchisement of these individuals that would suggest that their inclusion is actually beneficial. I don't know, someone could claim, for instance, that early participation would produce in the long run more competent citizens, more engaged citizens, even if in the short run they do not make very wise electoral decisions. So the problem is then, who is to say whether the overall long-term net effect is for the worse? We do not really have any sort of solid evidence to prove this, and it would be unacceptable in a scheme of universal suffrage to exclude some other broad class of persons on the basis of such weak evidence. So I think we should apply the same standard for these classes of persons. So if I'm right about this, the epistemic case for disenfranchisement, for disenfranchising these classes of persons is hard to justify. And just to give some anecdotal evidence about this, in Canada, for instance, many mentally impaired individuals started suing in court. They claimed that their rights had been violated because there was a provision in Canada that disenfranchised everyone who had been formally legally appointed a guardian. But many people who were in this situation still believed that they were competent and interested in exercising the right to vote, so they sued and they started winning the cases, their case. And at some point, Parliament, the issue came up to decision in Parliament in the 1990s. And in trying to come up with a more fine-grained criterion for determining who had the appropriate competence to vote, the Parliament simply concluded that there was no such effective criterion, and that the best thing was to err on the side of over-inclusiveness to ensure that everyone that was capable and interested had the right to vote. And since then, the disenfranchisement of mentally impaired persons in Canada was repealed, so no one is denied the right to vote on that basis. And to this point, you can look at the results. No one has shown and will show that the quality of electoral outcomes in Canada has clearly deteriorated since. So that's with respect to the argument. I mean, this is a negative argument in the book. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to dismiss the claim that their enfranchisement would reduce the quality of electoral outcomes. But then I make a more positive argument, which tries to identify a criterion for inclusion in this regard. So I develop what I call the franchise capacity. I develop this idea, which is basically the notion that individuals have the mental powers, the mental and moral powers to understand what an election is about and to have a legitimate interest in participating. And on the basis of this criterion, I look at empirical evidence on development studies to try to identify when we acquire this franchise capacity, this cognitive and moral capacity to value and understand the act of voting, and on that basis try to establish a more compelling threshold for allocating the right to vote. So I basically say that any person who has this franchise capacity should be allowed to vote, particularly in the irrespective of age, particularly because we do not have any good reasons to believe that doing so, franchising them, would deteriorate the quality of electoral outcomes. And now, just to give a rough idea of where this threshold of franchise capacity is, well, given the studies I consulted, individuals at the age of age already have this capacity, the franchise capacity. This is not to say that they are politically sophisticated as adults, or that they, you know, have the relevant experience and so on. It is simply to say that they have the mental hardware, so to speak, to make sense and to value the experience of voting, and that since there would be no other compelling reason for excluding them, then we should just presume that they should have this right on the same terms as everyone else.
Right, right. Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I'm sure that there are some 8-year-olds that are, in their political understanding, you know, every bit as sophisticated as some adults who are presently allowed to vote under universal suffrage. So let's move to the to these two classes with respect to residency. So under universal suffrage, we're concerned with non-citizens who reside within the given polity, and the conventional suffrage doctrine says it's permissible to exclude them, to disenfranchise them. And also under universal suffrage, we're concerned with citizens of the polity who do not reside in the polity. And again, under universal suffrage, the conventional suffrage doctrine says non-resident citizens get to vote. And you deny this. So tell us about the non-resident citizens and the citizen non-residents.
Sure. So I basically think that the status of having the status of citizen, specifically understood as nationality, being a national of a country, is neither necessary nor sufficient for being enfranchised. So basically what I want to do, what I do in this chapter, is argue for a dissociation of nationality, of citizenship, and voting rights. So the implications of this are that on the one hand, non-resident citizens may be justifiably disenfranchised, whereas non-citizen residents should be enfranchised. And I also examine the case of non-citizen non-residents, who some have recently argued that they should have the right to vote. So let me go through some of these claims.
Great.
Some people have argued for maintaining the current relationship between citizenship and the right to vote. And what they normally argue is that citizenship matters in the sense that it is important for people to be able to freely choose this form of identity, this form of belonging. And this freedom would be violated if we were to automatically grant citizenship and citizenship rights, the right to vote, to long-term residents in the polity. However, I find this line of argument uncompelling. I think the right to vote should be treated as we treat other political rights that are automatically granted to people on the base as they simply acquire the relevant conditions. So, for instance, think of other political rights like the right to freedom of political association or freedom of speech. We grant these rights to permanent residents, some temporary residents, and we do this because we think that they are in a position to value these rights and that these rights protect an important interest that they have. And I think that we should do exactly the same with the right to vote without establishing this middle step of voluntarily acquiring citizen status. So one solution would be just to give automatic citizenship along with the right to vote to long-term residents. The problem with this, according to critics, is that then this interest in being able to freely choose this identity would be undermined. So then an alternative would be not to grant citizenship automatically, but to grant the right to vote automatically. The problem with this alternative, according to the critics, is that it dissociates the status of citizenship with rights. In a way, it becomes an empty status. Now, to be honest, I don't think that's actually a problem at all. I'm perfectly happy with dissociating the formal status of member or of citizen with those rights, and it's not clear to me why that would be a problem. Actually, I think this is an argument, a position that I sort of outline in the book, but I don't really argue for it in detail. But I think this would be actually a better world if states simply recognized individuals as having different sets of rights, of course, but without, you know, having states going around allocating identity cards, which is basically what the status of citizen is. So, for instance, well, short-term residents would not have full political rights, but long-term residents would automatically have them, and some would have the right to enter and exit the country, immigration rights. Others wouldn't have it, but this would no longer be associated to one particular status, such as citizenship, to one form of belonging. So the idea would be that rights would be just automatically recognized and granted the moment that people fulfill the conditions and requirements for their exercise.
Excellent. The whole book I think is compelling in all kinds of ways, but one of the really compelling features and discussions in the book is the discussion of felons and persons who are incarcerated. And there, you again say under universal suffrage, there's no justification for the disenfranchisement of felons and incarcerated persons. And there you may rely on a distinction between the right to vote and the opportunity to vote. Can you tell us about how that argument works?
Sure. So the structure of the argument is the same as in the other chapter. So basically, I look at instrumental and non-instrumental considerations in trying to decide whether the exclusion or inclusion of these groups are justified. So as we were, you know, talking a little while ago about minors and the mentally impaired, so one important instrumental consideration is whether their enfranchisement would make things, would produce worse outcomes. I reject that. And a non-instrumental consideration is whether, you know, children and the mentally impaired have any legitimate interest in being allowed to vote, and that would depend, as I explained, on whether they have the franchise capacity. Now, the same line of analysis, the same kind of considerations I use to think about the other cases, including the case of felons. So from an instrumental point of view, someone might try to argue that the exclusion of felons is justified because they have already proven that they are incompetent to make a good use of the right to vote. However, when we try to translate that claim into the conclusion that their enfranchisement would actually have negative instrumental implications, then things are not that clear. And in this regard, the United States is a perfect natural experiment to think about this. Because, as you know, well, in some states, felons are allowed to vote, and in some states, they are not. And there is simply no evidence whatsoever to think that enfranchising felons would produce worse outcomes. In other words, there is no evidence that the states where felons are allowed to vote are in some way worse off than the state, and connected, you know, with the exercise of the right to vote by felons, than states where they are disenfranchised. So when we look at instrumental considerations, it is difficult to make the case. Now, when we think of non-instrumental considerations and the interests that felons might have in the right to vote, well, I think they have as strong an interest as anyone else. I mean, they have the capacity and the interest in valuing this opportunity. And this actually is an important point I want to just to clarify. You know, as I explained before, I have argued that the right to vote is not a fundamental right. But in saying this, I am not saying that the right to vote is not valuable at all. I'm not saying that we do not have an interest in being allowed to vote. I am not saying that it is not better to have it than not. No, I on the contrary, I do believe that the franchise has some value, personal value, for different reasons that I explain in the book. And this is true as well of felons. And to the extent that there are no good instrumental reasons to think that they should be disenfranchised, and to the extent that other arguments that I go over in detail in the book fail, such as the argument that, you know, the famous social contract argument that they have broken the law, then they're not eligible to decide who should make the law, and a number of other similar arguments that I try to reject in the book. So in the end, I conclude that the disenfranchisement of felons, which is one of the most important cases being discussed around the world, is not justified. Now, that said, I mean, this is not an entirely new conclusion, and admittedly, the arguments that I offer in the book, you know, draw from the literature. I mean, this has been a widely discussed issue, and I don't make any new, you know, innovative arguments showing why, you know, the disenfranchisement of felons is specifically wrong. What I think is the main contribution of this chapter is that it makes a distinction between a denial of the right to vote, which I call disenfranchisement proper, and a denial of an opportunity to vote. So denying someone the right to vote is to disqualify her as not being competent or as not having a sufficient interest in being allowed to vote in a given context. So this would be, a person would be formally disqualified to the disenfranchised to the extent that it is established that she is not allowed in any circumstance to cast a ballot on the basis of these considerations. Whereas a denial of an opportunity to vote of an enfranchised person is different. This simply means that a person might not enjoy an opportunity, an instance for actually casting a ballot. So just to illustrate, so imagine that you are hiking on election day and you're in the middle of a mountain and you want to exercise your right to vote. You're not disqualified in any way. You're not formally disenfranchised, but suppose you're in the middle of the mountain and you want to cast a ballot. Now, there would be technologies that would allow persons to cast a ballot from those circumstances. I mean, we could imagine an application that would allow them to vote from their smartphones or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we can discuss whether the absence of certain opportunities to vote are justified or not. We might say, well, look, you decided to go hiking on election day, and you don't really have a complaint that, you know, you have not been provided with a fair opportunity to vote. Whereas other instances, we might want to say that certainly count as violations of a fair opportunity to vote. But so once we have in mind the distinction between disenfranchisement, the denial of the right to vote proper, and the denial of an opportunity to vote, then this casts some important light on the question of felon voting rights in general. Because even though, as I argue in the book, I don't think that felons can be legitimately disenfranchised, I do believe that we do not necessarily have to go to every prison in the world and ensure that felons are allowed to vote in the next election. So why do I think this? Well, in many contexts in which the rule of law again is weak and there is corruption, unfortunately, this is not an exclusive condition of undeveloped democracies, but also this occurs in some pretty old and well-established democracies. The conditions of prisons do not really amount are not good enough to allow persons to cast a free vote, in the sense that prisons are often in some places controlled and run by criminal gangs, and there are good reasons to fear that the integrity of the electoral process in those circumstances could be seriously compromised. In extreme circumstances, I mean, this might be for some listeners hard to believe, but in my country, in Mexico, for instance, as in many other countries, some prisons are really places, really anarchical places where the last thing that you can imagine that would run smoothly is, the conduction of an electoral process. So, mm-hmm. Of course, I mean, the appropriate conclusion is that we should go, it is morally urgent that we go to all these places and ensure that people have adequate conditions and a life where they can, live with dignity and so on, and that among other things, they would be allowed to cast a ballot. But in the meanwhile, the question, what do we do before that happens, is complicated, and I do not think that recognizing the right to vote of felons necessarily leads to the conclusion that we have to go to all these places, and irrespectively of the circumstances, felons should be allowed to vote. So that's basically the argument in that in that part of the book.
And am I remembering right that one of the ways in which you think an electoral process can go wrong, and one of the ways in which in certain, maybe very many, maybe most prisons, an electoral process would go wrong, is if the votes are coerced. Is that the worry?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there is, as I said, some prisons, some parts of some prisons are run and controlled by criminals, and they can have ways of messing with the process such that, yes, the votes would not be freely cast. I mean, there is, that's a context that is ripe for all sorts of electoral fraud that we might have, that we have good reasons not to to prevent. So, yes, but, you know, the manipulation of ballot boxes, coercion, you know, we would have to first make sure that felons have just basic adequate information about, you know, the contest itself, you know, the candidates, their proposals and so on. And so this would be difficult to accomplish, at least in some contexts. Now, that said, I do believe that there are some countries in where the prison system, you know, would allow this to happen perfectly. So, actually, let me give an illustration. You know, there is a trend now. I mean, more and more people are advocating for other forms of punishment, you know, alternatives to imprisonment. Well, such as wearing GPS bracelets, mm-hmm. And if a person is in that situation and she is able to attend a regular voting booth, I mean, that would be no problem at all. So the problem is only in those circumstances in which imprisonment takes place under such conditions of, you know, uncertainty regarding the integrity of the process that, you know, we might be justified in not not going ahead and establishing mechanisms that would allow felons to vote from prison.
Well, excellent. That's fascinating. Claudio, you've been very generous with your time, and we're running out. I wonder if I can ask you, just as a last question, to say something about the place that you see this book and your work, and maybe even some work that you're looking at in the future. Where does this reside, or what kind of impact would you like the book to have on current democratic theory, or where do you think your book sort of lands within that broader field?
Well, you know, one of the main questions, if not the most important question in democratic theory, has to do precisely with the justification of democracy. And I'm somewhat unsatisfied with the way in which political philosophers have approached this question, in the sense that typically people try to make very broad and general and abstract arguments for something that, you know, it's often described as the right to political participation or the right to have a say. Now, there is no such thing. There is no such thing as the right to participate or the right to have a say. What there are instead are different political rights: the right to freedom of speech, the right to freedom of association, the right to run for office, the right to vote, and other more specific rights. Thinking seriously about democracy is to think seriously about specific institutions. So, this book, I think, is an effort to try to to make a contribution in that direction. So I have singled out the right to vote for serious scrutiny, and I would like, I mean, if I could make a wish, I would like to see more, studies of this sort, more philosophical inquiries on specific, on concrete institutions rather than abstract, phenomena such as the right to have a say or the right to political participation. I, by the way, do think that some political rights are basic fundamental rights. For instance, the right to freedom of political speech. But I have a different view regarding the right to vote, as I have, as I tried to explain in this book. So the book tries to make a contribution on this more institutional-oriented approach to democratic theory that I think it traces back to thinkers such as Tocqueville, or more importantly, John Stuart Mill, or the Federalists, for instance. I mean, it seems that some contemporary work in democratic theory is a little bit too abstract and disengaged with real practical issues of institutional design. And I think it would be desirable to start to go back to that tradition, of doing political philosophy, which involves, serious moral thinking about concrete, specific institutions. So if I had to describe what this book tries to do in general, well, I could take no better example than John Stuart Mill's considerations on representative government. Although instead of Mill's broad focus on all the institutions of representative governments, here I have singled out the franchise. And well, of course, there are some notable examples of this kind of theorizing among contemporary scholars. One obvious case is Dennis Thompson, who has been an important inspiration for me among others. So I hope the book is regarded as a contribution in that sense.
Well, excellent, Claudio. You've been it's been great to talk to you about your book, Democracy and Disenfranchisement: The Morality of Electoral Exclusions. Thanks so much for appearing on New Books in Philosophy.
No, on the contrary, Bob, I really appreciate your time, and it's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you. Take care now.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Claudio Lopez Guerra of the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics in Mexico City. We were talking about his new book, Democracy and Disenfranchisement: The Morality of Electoral Exclusions, published by Oxford University Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.